everybody. Welcome to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast.
That's right.
Sitting across from me, feet up on the table like he's on summer vacation or a high school teacher at the end of the school year, is Will Hines.
Sitting across from me like a petulant, unrepentant student who needs a good life lesson, It's John Frusciante.
We just did a great thing of classic pairs.
That's right.
Right there.
The old,
anybody who knows your 101 curriculum.
Yeah, that's right. We did a really long and self-involved version of classic pairs. Who's our guest today, John Frusciante?
Oh, God, who is it? I don't know.
Well, look to your left about a foot and a half away from you and identify that man.
Our guest this week is the fantastic, hilarious, charming, handsome, effervescent Ben Remeka.
Ben Remeka, that's right.
Wow. That's
rhymes with Jamaica.
Mm-hmm. Rhymes with Jamaica.
Mm-hmm. Not Remeka.
Not Remeka, right. Not Ramiaka.
Yeah, I'm hoping that this podcast will help put to bed the mispronunciations of Ben's name.
That's the main reason we had him on.
All right, we'll see you next week, everybody. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for coming. With us always is our podcast intern, Sypha Sounds.
Mm-hmm, that's
good
right.
Good morning or evening or whatever.
Sypha about to embark on a trip to Italy. So
that's exciting.
Yeah.
When you first said that, Sypha, before we started, I thought you said Italy. And I was like, well, oh, yeah, that's exciting.
You're just going to the food place in Harold Square.
And 9 days, I realized, oh, I'm having a disconnect about, yeah. I don't know why.
He's going to get locked in there, like the mixed up files of Mrs. Basil E. Frank Wheeler. Yeah. He's just going to hide in Italy.
No, Sypha's going to go for 9 days to Italy.
It would be like The Terminal, the movie The Terminal with Tom Hanks. Except,
oh, we've all seen that movie.
Sorry, just good reference. But Sypha would just be like getting macchiatos and like very hard cheeses.
Off mic, as always.
Did you say Cheez-Its?
No, cheeses. Hard cheeses.
Oh, Cheez-Its.
Oh, boy.
Stale Cheez-Its in Italy.
No, because that the girl at the jam last night who was.
There was a disruptive
wacko
person at the jam.
Uh huh. Hopefully she's listening.
And
I don't think she's
the suggestion for that set was Cheez-Its.
Oh.
So that's what Sypha's referring to.
That was the suggestion? Because she kept saying, I didn't know it was the suggestion.
That's why she kept saying the suggestion.
She kept saying it.
Like throughout or when she first stepped out on stage?
She just kind of worked it into her lines a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Anyway, off mic is Keaton Patty.
Podcast intern's intern.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
That's right.
Yeah, so Ben, thanks for being on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I told myself that I wouldn't say like long-time listener, first-time guest. But
you
just
said
did.
It.
Yeah.
It's hard not to.
Mm-hmm. Have people said that before?
I don't know, but it feels like they should.
I think you're the first one.
Really?
Yeah.
Man.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe it. I'm a big fan. I've been thinking about this for a long time.
Oh,
that's
yeah?
flattering.
No bit. I listened to all
nice.
The podcasts, and I...
You know what? Because you said that, I want to start this interview in a kind of unconventional way.
Sure.
You said you've been thinking about this for a long time. There's got to be like one... There's probably a bunch of things that you're like... I want to talk about this on the podcast.
Just for us as interviewers, it'd be interesting to know that. Like, yeah.
So give me one of the things that you've been fantasizing in your head about talking
doesn't
about.
Doesn't have to be the best. Just one of them.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Just doesn't have to be the best.
Right.
I mean, there have been several that I've thought about. I mean, one is like a stupid Zen philosophy. Oh, I was thinking about it in the shower yesterday.
Go ahead.
No, it's there's a T.S. Eliot thing about it's called? The quartets?
Yeah,
you know that?
Four quartets.
The four quartets. Well, is that redundant? Quartets?
Oh, maybe it's... Oh, yeah, maybe just the quartets.
I don't know, but maybe you're right. But one of the... It's like a bunch of short poems, but one of them is like, the end is the beginning, is the end, is the beginning, and the fire. I'm paraphrasing. T.S. Eliot wraps into the rose. Yeah. Is it Wasteland? I mean, he was
Keaton, I could tell early, you should just be ready to look a bunch of stuff up during this one.
Yeah, I wish I had my laptop in here. Anyway.
But the idea of the end is the beginning, I think about that a lot. It's like when I started off and people were always saying, like, these are the basics. This is what you need. And the longer I do it, the more I just come back to that, the simplicity of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that, like, nothing's wasted
right.
if you're doing it well. And that it really is listening, creating a base reality.
So you go for a while of thinking it's more complicated than that, and then it's like, nope, it's just these simple things.
It's just these simple things.
Mm-hmm.
And even like last night, I was coaching a group that was very good getting ready for Herald auditions. And I was just like, make those strong choices. That's it. Make those strong choices and establish that base reality.
Yep.
And then just listen. But we forget. We get ahead of ourselves. We want to run before we can walk.
Yeah.
But I'm just like, the end is the beginning. is the end. It's like what we showed you at the very beginning is exactly what TJ and Dave are doing. Maybe it's a little bit slower, but it's still just that sort of like Zen archery, pull the bow back, wasted.
So what does that mean for you when you talk about like listening, creating that base reality? What are you looking to do? Because like there's this other thing I've been kind of noticing that like I think there's a difference between groups and improvisers that listen to the most valuable things and people who get hung up on less interesting or less valuable things. And I think maybe we've all been there as improvisers in our lives. Like,
I love quibbling.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. And I think like when we were on Badman together, I think we used to get the note that we would like go down the rabbit hole too much. Like we would get like lost in these kind of tangents that might not necessarily have served our scenes.
Yeah. Anthony said it would be like Christmas morning. And we would get a ton of gifts, and we would open all the gifts, but not play with a single one.
Right.
We just continually open gifts and just get lost.
So, like, for you, what does that mean to, like, listen and build a reality?
I mean, if we're getting really technical, right? So we're in the yes-anding phase, and I'm building that base reality with somebody. Mm-hmm. First of all, like, I think as you go on in your evolution as an improviser, you're continually integrating tools that are taught to you until they become subconscious. Mm-hmm. But there is a mental checklist that goes by that's like, okay, so what's missing right now? I don't know what our relationship is, and I don't know where we are. I know what we're doing. You know, we're sitting here talking about our soon to be born baby in this waiting room. That's totally fine.
Right.
And I guess that implies a relationship now that I'm saying it. But if those things aren't filled in, I'm looking to actively do that.
Okay.
Cause it's all about once you have to define that again to see what that unusual thing is. It's like, you don't know what the context is, because if your relationship is totally normal, then an unusual thing's not going to pop up. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's not until you put that thing that creates the contrast that like, oh, I'm not talking to, let's do away with like the pregnancy example, I guess. But if I'm just saying, if I'm in a scene and you realize I'm talking to a 12-year-old as opposed to, say, my dad, that dynamic changes everything immediately. Mm-hmm. Either in a comedic way or not.
Yeah.
So I'm always looking to fill that in. Mm-hmm. I think about it a lot, like sometimes in acting terms, like it's called your given circumstances. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the given circumstances of the scene? Like, there's a big difference between the way you talk on a subway platform as to the way you talk when you're in the subway.
Yeah.
If we're on a subway platform, we're like, oh man, that homeless guy is really fucked up. Look at, he's like, I always go blue with my example, sorry. But like, he's shitting himself. And then as soon as you walk through the door to the subways, you're like, he's shitting himself and I can't believe he was just doing it. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Without even knowing it. Mm. So our whole life is like, fill in that backdrop, because you have a wealth of information after living on this earth that tells you how to act in these circumstances, which then tells you when that unusual thing happens and you can be like, that's a departure. Mm. That's it. In terms of listening, Anthony King said, we say the word listening, but people don't understand that what we mean is awareness, right? You have to like take in everything about somebody when they come into a scene.
Yeah.
Because what they're saying might not match like their intention.
Yeah.
What they want to get out of you.
Yeah.
You know? So
that's true.
I try really hard to be like, do you want something from me? What do you want? And how can I get that to you as an actor? Like, what does this actor want me to do for his character? Mm-hmm. So I try to be aware. And then if the person doesn't know what they're doing, I just like make a choice and become really paranoid about one thing that they said. Kind of, not really.
One of the things that you know, ideally, when you improvise with people, especially long term, like I think you should be watching for things that people do better than you and trying to get as good as them, you know, or like, you know, just on a general level, you notice what people are great at. And one of the things that I think you're great at that I've learned that like you remind me to be better at this is giving those gifts to people.
Yeah.
And I guess that's like establishing the base reality for you or filling in that checklist
in
your head. You know, you give very good, specific gifts to people in improv scenes.
I thought of another thing I thought of in the shower that I wanted to say.
Go ahead.
That I've thought about for years. But let me finish on that thought. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actively try to be like, let's just set this up. Mm. And personally, when you're really cooking, when a scene feels great, like, yes, and in a Herald, nothing is wasted. But personally, I feel like the first 30 seconds of a scene are kind of a wash. Not like they doesn't matter. Like, certainly it does matter. But by the end of a scene or by the end of a set, if you killed it, Like, nobody remembers that you, like, had an accent
right.
for a second.
Right.
Nobody remembers that you both spoke at the same time or it was garbled.
Yeah.
Like, if you murder it, they're just like, man, that was insane.
Yeah.
So I'm like, just like you can take your time at the top of a scene, like, why not just knock it out? Mm-hmm. Like, say who you are to each other, where you are. Just label it. And even if it is, like, a little bit rote, if it sounds like a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. like, not colloquial, that's fine, because then you can just get to playing. We're done. Yeah. Get out of the way. Boom. We're
on our
way.
Combating when you say that? Like, what are you responding to? Because I think, like, you tell people to slow down and take it easy at the top of the scene to, like, because that's where a lot of bad listening, bad awareness happens.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of times if you're teaching people, the first 10 seconds you can see their heads full of the suggestion.
Yeah.
Or if there's an opening, their heads full of the opening, and they're not even noticing how each other is walking into a scene. And if you want people to get better, it's like you could just pay attention to each other a lot earlier. That would help your scenes.
Yeah.
But that I think is in could go against.
Yeah.
It doesn't conflict with the intention of your note, but it's a different process. Your process is like, hey, let's just get the work done.
Yeah.
Even if it's in a non-artful way, let's do that quick because no one's going to remember that anyway. And then the sooner we get to play with it, it'll be worth it. But
yeah. You're right.
That's going to put people on the mindset of just like laying out a who, what, where without watching each other because you're like, this is disposable.
Yeah, I guess it is like a little bit of like, obviously people have to walk before they can run.
Are you saying?
So I'm wondering what you're in response to. Like what kind of scenes are you thinking about when you're like, hey, these first 30 seconds, no one's going to remember them. Let's knock out our who, what, you know, that sounds like a note you're given after having watched scenes.
Yeah, I think I'm taking for granted the fact that they should be listening. I mean, if people aren't listening to each other, then that's the first thing you're going to say. You're talking over each other. You're not listening.
Yeah.
You're both saying stuff, but you're hearing each other, but not listening.
Right.
Here's what you're saying reminds me of. Maybe I'm being a little presumptuous here, but it sounds like that kind of, not necessarily beginning improviser, but sort of maybe mid-level kind of thing where like you see two people. This is the typical scene that you see all the time, I think. Two people come out and they like, both bring chairs, and then there's this confusion about where the chairs are going to go, and then the scene becomes about the chairs.
The worst.
You know?
Yeah.
And it sounds like that's part of what you're like addressing. Like, if little kind of things like that happen at the beginning of the scene, it's okay that that's not what the scene is.
Yes, that's right.
About. If the one person wanted to make it a car, but you sat across from each other, you're saying, just pull the seat over and go into the car.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's like the top of a scene is a wash. I think overall, I'm just saying, like, make a strong decision. Like, don't be afraid. Like, frequently what I see happen.
I see what you mean. What John's talking about is what those notes are in reaction to. I know that moment.
Right.
You make too big a deal over the small, what could be missteps. When really, if you just decide it's not a big deal, then it's just not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And no one's going to remember it. And they forgive. The audience forgives a ton of adjustments in the first 30 seconds.
Well, I think that is a whole other world of just like, just be confident. Like if you don't feel good about yourself, like fuck it. Just fake it out on stage. That sells things a lot. That can sell things a lot more. And I think young improvisers see that empty stage and their fuse is so fast. I got to get out there. I got to do something without making decisions. And I think it's more powerful to come out on stage, wait a beat. This is your stage. Get out there. I mean, you can land with excitement too, but like the need to like fill that space. There's something to be said for like, we're here. Like when I used to watch The Stepfathers before Will got on and I refused to go anymore.
Before I ruined it, right.
That's right.
When it was still a good team.
Would always come out with like a presence and like a pace, and you guys still do. And like just the confidence. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which I always
remember. Yeah, I remember seeing veteran teams when you're a student or even still. Like, just the calmness and the poise is the most striking thing. It's like, oh, they know they're going to get there.
Yeah.
And in a weird way, it's contagious. You start to relax.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part is that the audience is on your side. I think improvisers feel a need. Young improvisers feel a need. Like, I got to get them. We got to do something. But improv audiences are amazing. They're unique. They want you to do well. They're supportive. They are impressed by what's going on. They're impressed even though they're scared most times. Mm-hmm. And they think, first-time audience are like, I don't think I could do that.
Yeah.
The majority of them. And they want, they're like, they like that risk that you're taking.
In any moment of indecision they see, they start to feel bad for the performers. They're like, oh, they're not going to be able to do it.
Yeah.
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 I think we lose track of that. The other thing I talk about in my classes a lot too is that I'll have people gift each other in the scenes. Mm. And I'll even ask them to like over gift each other, and nobody can really do it. Nobody can really. I was in a class once with a guy and 201, we were learning about game. It was 301. We were still working on game, and he like over gifted me, but it's the only time it's ever happened. It was just like, well, Ben, you're a piano player. You're going to sit down to this piano. When you play a song, your bowels are going to erupt, and then I'm going to be really angry at you because the guy just went on and on and on. And I was like, well, I'm locked in this little box now.
Yeah, too much.
This sucks because now I can see
whole
thing.
Yeah, you got handed a script, and there's no room for you to do anything.
Exactly. It was just like a pimp, basically. But mm-hmm. when I ask other people to like really lay out for somebody else, really give them a big gift, and then they do it, they never pimp that badly. They just make really strong decisions about somebody else. Mm-hmm. And then I asked the other person that they gifted, how did you feel about that? Did you feel railroaded? Did you feel like a piece of shit that couldn't do anything? And they're like, no, it felt great.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's what we don't realize when we're coming up. It's like when you gift somebody, you're happy to get that gift. You're like, man, you just gave me a big signpost that tells me exactly what I have to do for the rest of the scene.
Yeah.
Even if it's so simple, just the word dad. You're just like, I'm a dad. I've seen dads. Maybe I had a dad growing
right.
up. I can play a dad. And this is the kind of dad I'm going to play. Mm-hmm. But we don't do it.
Yeah, like, I say this in classes. I learned this from Miles. He said, the best thing somebody can do is call me an asshole in an improv scene. Because then I just play an asshole for the rest of the scene. You know? So yeah, that kind of gifting, we sometimes don't realize that like each improviser just wants the other one to make a choice.
This is Miles Davis who told you this?
Miles Davis, yeah. Mm-hmm. He told me that. Yeah. And then
erupted
your back on the audience.
Flamenco sketches.
Right.
He just came in
and then,
blue and green. Yeah,
and then didn't like me because I was white.
Oh, is that true?
Isn't that true?
I don't know.
He was
true
about Miles Davis. Pretty angry about
anybody.
That's true.
You know who was great though is Cannonball Adderley. He was terrific.
Really?
Yep.
You out-referenced me.
Oh, did I? He was part of the personnel of Kind of Blue.
Oh, really?
I think he was the alto sax player. Oof. Really laid back about white people.
Yeah.
You don't know?
I don't know.
Adderley?
No.
No, you're bullshitting, right?
No, I'm not bullshitting you.
You know everything.
I know.
Wow.
But there are limits. I have Birth of the Cool. That's a CD I have. Mm-hmm. It's really great. But I don't know too much about.
Everybody should have. Every improviser should have Kind of Blue.
Yeah.
Why?
This is getting really weird. Because it's improv. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know my like Kind of Blue history perfectly, but like he just came in. He had key changes. He had like a time signature, and then they just played. He's like, just play. And then they just refined it. I mean, you can find like alternate takes of flamenco sketches and stuff. Mm-hmm. But like Freddie Freeloader, he was just like, so you have like a musical score.
Yeah.
And he would just have, for this many measures, we're going to play in this key. Mm-hmm. And then for this many measures, we're going to play in this key. And that's it.
Yeah.
It's like, here's your suggestion. Let's go. Or like Van
Morn. Or more like outlining beats, really.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So maybe it's more like sketch in that sense.
Sketch prof.
Yeah. Or even Van Morrison's Astral Weeks, where he just got like the best jazz players around and was like, play what you feel.
Yeah. Mm. You got one, John? I got a question.
Go ahead.
So, Ben, you're how much of this is in your head when you're improvising? I want to how much of this is in your head now, and then I want to ask about when you were coming through classes.
How much of it is in my head?
Like, you're on stage. How much are you thinking consciously about rules?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know really how to describe it. What are the things like you watch, like when the Amtrak thing changes, when you're at Penn Station?
Like the list of when the trains are leaving?
Yeah, when the train's leaving and it goes like tick, 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 and then the letters fill in.
Yes.
I feel like it's almost like that. Like that I've been doing it long enough that sometimes like it just sort of fills in that I'll be going through a scene. What's missing? Okay, our location. What's missing? Boom. Da-da-da-da. And it's not, it just kind of comes up like impulse, like, and then I just make a decision.
You're just aware that there's a blank and you fill it in.
The impulse starts with me being aware that there's a blank. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like, I'm like, there's a hole here. What is it? And then I'll go through, oh, it's a location or it's our relationship. Because again, I think you can't find that thing that sticks out until you've laid all that other stuff there.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a little mathy. But then that lets me get to an organic place. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you have an acting background, and you had a lot of acting training before you started improv.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny for me to hear you. I always assumed that someone with an acting background would come at it in a real acting way, that you'd be like stepping out on stage and thinking about like character and story and like context and stuff first.
Well, let me qualify what I just said.
Okay.
I guess when I'm doing that, it's cooking with a premise off the back line, or I'm playing straight man. Mm-hmm. Then it kind of does that like Penn Station thing.
Yeah.
But if I'm feeling it, like if I'm playing like gut wise,
yeah,
then I'm just what Christina Gaussis says is like a weight and a heat. Like I just arrive and then I'm there. And that's more like the acting thing.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's just a philosophy, or I just come in.
What do you mean by weight and heat? I've heard that at TJ and Dave sort of exercises, but what are you thinking of when you say it?
Every human being has a weight and a heat. And whatever that means to you, like the person who comes in, like it's like the Bobby Wheeler, like, hey, I'm Bob, you know, that guy, like when you come in the taxi, this is a terrible reference. he would be like shucking and jiving and like, you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. he had that very manic energy.
Right.
And he would move, I don't know, like a hummingbird or something.
You know what, Jeff Conway, the actor on Taxi?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Well, his character was Bobby Wheeler.
Yeah. I'm just making sure I got you right.
Jeff Conway.
You're not making up a hypothetical name and a character.
Oh, no.
You're talking about a specific...
The character Bobby Wheeler who would like...
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, so let's... To keep up with like the early 80s, 70s reference.
Thank
like,
you.
Even the Travolta character from Welcome Back, Kotter. Like, mm-hmm. hey, yeah, you know, Vinny Bob, whatever. Like, he had a very... That was like a smaller energy, but very specific.
Yeah.
So I feel like every time we come in a character... comes on a stage, it has a weight and a heat.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie Dunn, like 2 weeks ago, played this guy in a hippie commune in an Airwolf show.
Okay.
And it was a character he'd never played before.
Oh, yeah, like, yeah. This was, yeah. Mm.
Donald.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, everybody be cool.
Yeah.
Donald.
And I'd never seen that energy from Eddie before.
He's usually much more like alpha and aggressive and like,
yeah,
I'll bring the rain. I'm the rainmaker.
Yeah.
Or like, I have...
But he was like hunched over and like... You know, very hippie-ish.
Yeah.
Very like a light energy.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. every character, when I'm in that mode, when I'm coming in as a character, then I'm just, I don't know what the word is, id? I'm just in that character's place.
Right.
And then the game moves come a lot more organically for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think. In the straight man role, I'm like just looking to set people up. Here's this thing. Let's do it. Here's your next game move. I just want to like... tee the ball so they can like put the ball on the tee so they can knock it out of the park.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to set it up.
Yeah.
React, set up.
Where does the, if you're coming in as a character with that kind of energy and that weight, where does that, what's the genesis of that for you? Like how much off the back line or on the back line are you aware of that? How do you get to that place?
I don't know. I mean, I think like it's like it's a muse thing sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember one of the first scenes I ever did on Ragnarok.
Your first Herald team.
My first Herald team. Do we have to name everybody?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Name the original cast of Ragnarok.
Original cast of Ragnarok. I'll start with the probably most obscure, Jill Donnelly.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, Jill Donnelly.
No, is that the most obscure? That's crazy. She's such a standout.
Maybe is it because that she
moved to LA.
She's moved to LA right now. She's terrific. I'm not saying that she's...
I know.
She was awesome.
People in LA do listen to this podcast,
by
the way.
Jill, if you're listening, you're wonderful and incredible. Jill, Donnelly, Morgan Jarrett, Emily Axford, Brian Glidewell, Patrick Clare, Winston Knoll, and Eric Dies.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And Ben
Maker. A little bit of an Eric Dies impersonation at the end.
Yeah.
Eric Dies. I hope you listen to this. I remember I stepped out. We had done an invocation. An invocation was hard for me to pull stuff from. I didn't really like it. Yeah, I wasn't very good at like just pulling organic stuff. But there was something in about a lawnmower, something about like a rusted lawnmower that was left outside by a dad. And I came out, and I'm not a first beat guy, but I came out in the first beat with Morgan and a beer bottle. I remember I stepped out, and there was a beer bottle in my hand.
Did your first show, the first Ragnarok show?
I think it was it wasn't our first show. Okay. Second, maybe third. So first time I was like, that felt good. I can do this. And I stepped out, and I said, you know, Kelly, sometimes dads leave. And I was like, and then I was just in. I was like, I got this dad. He's like a proud of being a deadbeat, like, piece of crap. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then I was just off. I don't know.
So it was this kind of, like, you sort of set yourself up in a way. Like, the line kind of came out, and then you were like, I get it. It's kind of like throwing the football in the air and then running to catch it.
Oh, it makes you sound so selfish.
No, I don't think that's a selfish thing at all. I think I don't think it's a selfish thing at all. I think it's a good thing to be able to do.
Yeah. It was the first time I felt like, I mean, it just was just a gut thing.
Because what you're doing is you're giving yourself a gift and then you're accepting it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you're giving yourself a gift and then you're yes-anding that.
And I honestly think that that's something that you do have to do. And on Herald Night, it's difficult because when I first got there, I was very much like support-oriented. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of our early Heralds, I would just sit out and I would initiate the two group games where I do walk on for support. Mm-hmm. And then after a couple months, I'd be like, God, why am I so pissed? And I'd be like, you're not fucking getting your own, dude. You got to get your own. You got to like get out there and be in a beat, feel good about it. Mm-hmm. And also, you can't save a Herald. It's impossible.
Yeah.
And to make that assumption was like sort of like condescending to the rest of the group and maybe a little bit insulting, I felt like, mm-hmm. that I would be back being like, I'm going to make sure this goes well. Like, we all have to make sure it goes well.
Yeah.
And the thing that I realized after a long time, we can talk about this too if you want. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I was the best teammate at that time in my development. But the best thing you can do for a Herald is just to literally have a good beat. That's it. Go in, have a good beat. This is what I believe.
Right.
It'll be like a tent pole for the rest of the Herald, and at least you have that beat. And maybe the others fall in line. Maybe not, but like at least you have that. But to sit back and be like, I'm going to make sure it works. I'm going to get in there. I'm going to corral it or make sure everybody, you can't do it. You know what I mean? You can't do it.
Yeah.
You think you might have been too controlling or something like that?
I don't know. I mean,
how do you mean bad teammate? You guys seem, I mean, I think you all, I remember Ragnarok being from the outside. I, of course, can't speak to the experience, but it seemed like a pretty happy and respectful team.
Yeah, I think
so. The team seemed to respect each other's talents pretty well, I thought.
Yeah, I thought so too. I just think that I wasn't playing the way I wanted to play at first on Herald Night. And I think we suffered from the same thing that every first team does, which is just like, you were the funniest person on your indie team, and you come in, and compromise is like hard. It's hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, we would talk a lot about like openings, and I mean, I felt like I compromised a lot. I'm sure people would disagree.
Yeah.
And that wasn't always the case, but I was very much like, we're not all going to get what we want.
Yeah, I think Delaney talked about a lot of Herald teams being like a chessboard of eight queens or something like that. Like, everyone's used to being able to do a lot. It's like, well, you're not going to be able to this time.
Yeah.
There's not room for it.
It's like you kind of have to like subjugate your own will. And it's right from the get-go. It's like the name and the song.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, Airwolf, when we picked our name, it was 10 seconds.
Yeah, and it came out of a scene in a Herald in practice.
Yeah, it was just like, let's get it done.
I think that's pretty common. The first team name you pick, you spend forever. And then your third team, it's like, whatever, let's just call it piece of shit or whatever.
I mean, what I ended up doing is, the meeting was going on so long and Ragnarok had three names left. And I was like, let's just vote to see which name advances to the last one. And Ragnarok got the most votes as to which one should advance. And I'm like, it's Ragnarok. Okay. Like, I felt like we had to just like trick people into getting it.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of being a bad teammate, and I see this and I try to note people on it, I was very bad about passive aggressively like noting Ragnarok, which I didn't know about until Gethard told me like a year.
Gethard coached you guys for a whole first year, really.
He coached us for the first year, and then like we broke up with him, or he broke up with us. It was mutual. And and then like a couple months later, he's like, you passively know people after exercise. I was like, what? He's like, we would finish an exercise and you'd be like, Gethard, didn't you want us to do this thing? And I was like, holy shit, I do that.
Wow.
I did that for a year. I'm like, I can't believe Ragnarok never killed me. and it gives me a little bit of empathy for people that do it in my classes. I still shut them down immediately. I'm like, you know what you did there? Don't do that. But I know from my own experience that it comes from a good place. It comes from a place of like, I want us to be good. Why can't we do this?
Right.
But it just comes across as so condescending.
And
one of my most like shameful things.
It's impressive to me that when Gethard said it, you didn't get defensive about it. I can't even say whether that's true or not about what you're saying, but for a coach to say that. And that's a pretty... It makes sense to me that he didn't say that for the first like year. That's a heavy thing to say to somebody.
Yeah, I guess so.
I think it meant he trusted you when he told you.
Yeah.
And it speaks well that you sort of like tried to see it honestly. I think that's one of the hardest things. It would be hard for me to hear like if somebody, I don't know, whatever bad habit I have, it was like, yeah. Oh yeah, Will, you do this. And everyone around me who's played with me like, yeah. And it would be hard to hear.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that people were surprised coming up. I would always remark on like my teachers and coaches, because I think when you meet me, you think I'm a certain type of person, and certainly like I'm definitely like a site-specific extrovert, as all of us who perform here are. Mm-hmm. But when I'm in a classroom setting, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, always. Like I'm much more comfortable like assuming a student role. And I know in like the first week when I'd get to higher level teachers that like knew me or somebody who is new would coach me, I don't push back. Like I want to learn. Like I respect you. I would just accept it. So when he said that, I mean, there was other stuff too that I just didn't know.
Yeah.
Like Gather would just be like, don't edit your own scene, Ben. And I'd be like, oh, I shouldn't do that. Or don't edit, I'm sorry, on your own line. Like I said a line once and then I edited.
Yeah, that looks bad.
And it does look bad.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I just was like, and he was like, don't do that. And I was like, yeah, don't do that. That does look bad. And I'm like, you know, you don't know that. Or like I took a openings and group game workshop with Christina Gausis and we're doing an organic opening. Mm-hmm. And I think I had just been put on Ragnarok and it was organic-y and like I said jazz hands and she was like, never say jazz hands. And I was like, I should never say jazz hands. I'm very comfortable with being like, you have something to offer me and I'm still learning. I'm not fully
never born. Say jazz hands.
She was right. I don't think she ever liked me after that. After I made a jazz hands move.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. What I wanted to say earlier, the thing that I thought about for a year when you started the podcast was about being like in baseball, you want to be a multi-tooled player, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be able to hit for average.
Hit for power. Field, throw, run.
Right. Which are the five tools. You want to be a five tools player. Mm-hmm. And coming up, as an improviser, all that stuff was really important to me. It was like, and I tried to figure it out one time, but it's like, you want to be able to play straight man. You want to play unusual person. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to edit.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this. I think this is interesting about you. I think like you're a very competitive or ambitious, or you like getting it right and being good at it.
Yeah.
Not for the sake of beating other people, but just for the sake of being good. I don't see you as a...
Sometimes for the sake of beating other people. No, no.
Let's talk about when I met you.
Yeah.
Which is when you were in your level two class with Delaney. Was it two or three?
Level two class with Delaney? No. What?
You were in a Delaney class. Oh, it must have been like five.
Five, yeah. Okay. I was Shannon O'Neill, Doug Moe, Charlie Todd, Gethard, Delaney, King. And I strategically, as soon as I finished halfway through Charlie Todd, I was like, I need to get into classes with people that are on the Herald committee. So I guess this speaks to your point.
Yeah, yeah.
Being driven.
And sort of strategic, I think, also.
Yes.
Well, yes. Actually, let's jump to that. What about, so yeah, what you were real, you were, the contradiction from my impression of meeting you was,
there
was
a lot. Triple Crown?
I think it was Triple Crown when you were freaking out about being in Delaney's class. I think Greg Aponte.
Greg Aponte was there.
Greg Aponte was in my. I had been in my classroom.
Yeah, it's an obscure Greg. Does it a good? Still a great friend of mine.
Yeah,
was in my first indie team, Bloody, and then my team, Load. Two great names that nobody knows about. We came up with Thank You Robot.
Yeah,
we hung.
You were in the first sort of big wave of indie teams.
Yeah, and I forget that, but I was so in my head.
I met you at Triple Crown and Greg introduced me to you and you were like, I'm in this Delaney class. He hates me. What can I do? And I was like, you can never, well, I don't remember what you remember. I remember saying like, you can't make him like you. You have to not care about it. You have to just like do the class. You can't win him over.
No, I don't think I won Delaney over until he directed Onassis. And again, it was that thing where he was like, oh, Ben like takes notes and acts in scenes and listens to what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm very actively like, you're the director. I'll follow what you're saying. But in that class, it's that early improvising thing, man. I just pushed back.
Yeah.
I don't want to blow up Delaney's spot, you know?
Yeah.
But it was the way he runs the class for me was like,
I just thought it was interesting for you. It's like, you were in the spot of wanting to be like a success at the UCB.
Yeah.
You know that Delaney still, and I think even more so at that time, was like one of the kind of decision makers.
Yeah, Bobby called him the Yoda.
Yeah.
Bobby's like
guru.
Yoda.
Taught like a million classes a week, yep. way more than he teaches now. And was the Swarm still a team or was it Stepfather?
It was Stepfather's.
Okay, and so.
But he's notorious, Delaney, for not learning names.
He's no, yeah. Which, so if you're looking for validation from Delaney,
yeah,
and I'm, that he's, like a lot of teachers, you're not going to get it. You're not necessarily going to get it. He's not mindful of that.
No, which is fair.
That's totally fair.
And I could speak to that point in a second.
Speak to it now.
When you teach for a long time, there's a disconnect between what it was like going through it at the time.
Yeah.
And that's something that I actively combat as a teacher, which is like, I can't yell at you for doing a shitty doctor scene because it's probably the first shitty doctor scene you've done.
Right.
At the end of it, I can say, probably don't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, Get There when in 401 was like, don't do a shitty doctor scene.
Bad doctor man. Scenes. Yeah.
Bad doctor scenes. Because, you know, there was a Nichols and May album that came out 50 years ago where they did that. And you're like, oh, okay. Like,
yeah.
It's been done. It's not to the top of your intelligence. So for now that I'm teaching, I understand with Delaney that it's difficult. Like it's difficult to see that many people to be teaching it
yeah. mm-hmm.
and to be so proficient at it. It's hard to go back.
Yeah.
And to, you know, to see what people are going through.
Right.
I mean, you have to actively do it in classes to be like, I know this is your first time out there, you know, and try to guide.
Well, when I met you and you were freaking out about it, I remember thinking like, I don't know about this guy. Like, he seems really friendly and nice, but he's got this competitive air that I normally associate with people who end up not being nice. But you were nice. Yes. You were clearly nice and friendly. And so it's like, but I remember also thinking like, this isn't going to work. Anybody who's like this directly sort of trying to win it, that goes against God. Like improv sort of values.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I never, on stage, I have never seen you play in a way that I would characterize as like selfish or, you know, sometimes you're aggressive and confident, but I don't see it as like bad listening or anything. Yeah. But in this conversation, this first conversation when I didn't know you at all.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And I remember being like, I wonder if this guy's going to be like one of these like climbers that kind of alienates everybody. But you didn't. You weren't like that. Well, but I want to ask you like, obviously you did have some of that. You were thinking about who's on the Herald committee and how can I get on a team and how can I make my teacher like me?
Do have that, like you have the best of both worlds. You know, you're an incredibly nice, generous, caring, respectful person.
Jesus. And this podcast every day. Thank you guys. Also Van Halen.
What's that?
Best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Boy.
And you're aggressively goal-oriented and career-minded, you know? And so you're not, as Will mentioned, like, there have been people that I've seen come through here that are just, like, goal-minded, career-oriented assholes, you know?
Well, to the exclusion of being good team players, I guess.
Right, yeah.
Well, can I speak to that, like, in two ways?
Sure.
One was that, like, I grew up...
Only if the second way is in a parrot voice.
In a parrot, like...
Yeah, two ways. Yeah, one normal and one normal.
Do you feel that was over gifting, Ben?
No, that was right. That was perfect. Like, when you talk about your feelings, you're talking a parrot voice.
Yeah.
I would just say that, like, I grew up, I think a lot of us were, like, on the outside of, like, social circles coming up. And, like, it forced us to almost pursue things that were, you know, like, subculture on the outside. But I came up with a big, like, performance streak in a weird bravery. Like the first musical I ever went out for was South Pacific. This is going to get real weird.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in Vermont. It's all white. And they put me in like dark face makeup because I played a Polynesian child. Mm-hmm. But I went out for get that in. And then we did The Wiz in the eighth grade. I played the lion and it was just fucking straight up blackface. I'll show you pictures. Oh, a little 13-year-old white kid being like, I'm a mean old lion. It's not okay.
I do not understand. Whenever I hear about all white high schools doing The Wiz, it baffles my mind.
This was in elementary school. This is eighth grade.
Elementary school.
Yeah. So
anything. Like, why don't you just do The Wizard of Oz? I don't get it.
Four white kids being like, ease on down, ease on down. I mean, it's...
Yeah. Madness.
My cousin just is graduating high school, and she was telling me that either... I think in her junior high school, they did The Wiz. And it's like, why? Just do the fucking Wizard of Oz. Anyway.
Wiz has better songs.
I guess.
Yeah. It does have better songs.
Yeah.
It legitimately does. That's why. You know, I grew up like... I went out for the musical South Pacific... And I was in fifth grade, and there were only two parts for fifth graders.
Right,
I
told but you had mom, blackface experience already.
Yeah, I've been wearing blackface at home for years.
You did a Sammy Davis Jr. Candyman minstrel show.
Yeah, we would cakewalk after dinner to see who got the biggest slice of cake. Plantation humor is just hitting it. Great!
You did a good Amos and Andy. Oh, never mind. Go ahead.
It's the only part of the podcast we're going to publish.
Yeah, exactly. But my mom, I remember telling my mom, I went out for the musical, and she was like, oh, that's great, honey. Good luck. And
yeah.
It's just clear to me that she, to this day, she's like, I didn't think you were going to do it.
Yeah.
I didn't know you had any interest. I'd seen our next door neighbor play Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof the year before.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to do that.
Did your town only do like super ethnically oriented musicals?
Yes.
Is that what it was?
Yes. And Annie Get Your Gun. But they killed like American Indians in that, right?
I don't know.
I don't remember.
Me either.
But then I did it and it just took, I mean, I got the bug early, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not, I was like popular, but I was like alternative popular.
Where are you from? New Hampshire?
Born in Rhode Island, raised in Vermont.
Vermont. So this is like real rural kind of.
Yeah. I mean, it's near Burlington, so it's got like. It's a
so you
town.
Were probably like a real artsy. You must have stood out as a real like artsy dude in that environment.
We were on Lake Champlain, so it was a little bit more of like a wealthy town.
Yeah.
So, and we were middle class, like early Clinton years, Reagan to Clinton years, like barely upper middle class. My dad ran Burger King's, and I had to work at Burger King till I was 18 years old.
Okay.
So oh, yeah, that's right. Your dad owned like, Burger King franchise.
He ran them. And like owns like a small percentage. Okay. But my brothers and I had to work there. So there's just like continual lessons in humility.
Yeah.
So there were like popular rich kids there. It's a classic story that were like dicks.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And I had two older brothers and I was the younger brother that could like shit on a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I respond to the underdog thing a lot. So when
it's funny because you talk about being an outsider. I would never imagine you were an outsider.
That's
you
what
seem like a real
think.
Like charming, confident dude. I would picture you as like owning a Wall Street firm when you were like in ninth grade.
Oh man!
Like I would see you going to geometry like in a 3-piece navy blue double breasted suit.
I mean, I was such like I would be so maudlin. I mean, when August and Everything After came out my sophomore year
County
in high
Crows,
school,
County first Crows, to August.
I was just like, this is my life. It's like Adam Duritz gets me. I mean, I don't know why I gravitated towards that. And then from there, it just unfolded to like Tom Waits. And like, I went through like a weird Tori Amos phase. So here you go. When I was in seventh grade, my favorite group was the Indigo Girls.
Okay.
And
edit
I specifically
now.
Remember, not now. I specifically remember to listening to History of Us in my room. Oh, uh-huh. I'm changing the story. That's not right. I love the Indigo Girls, but I had gone out and I bought the tape single of Bonnie Raitt's I Can't Make You Love Me.
Great right. song.
Great song. Beautiful mm-hmm. song. And I bought the tape single at Tape World in the mall, and I'd come home, and I was listening to it on repeat. I would flip the tape cassette while I painted metal figures. I painted metal figures.
What?
But I did not participate in any like RPG role-playing games.
You just
I
painted
just,
them?
Like painted metal figures
like
at
the
my
pewter
desk.
Little... You yep. painted them?
I painted them and I would glue them together.
Wow.
I was a weird...
Yeah. And then what? What would you do with them afterwards?
I just put them around my room. I had like a little tchotchke thing my mom bought me.
Man, you are like a weird amalgamation of different things.
I don't know. It was really strange.
So you did a... Tell me the truth, candidly. Did you like UCB or not when you started doing it? How did you come to do UCB and what did you think of it?
People had told me for years that I should do it. I left college at UVM where I studied anthropology. My folks paid for it. They said, you can go to the actor's studio. Or I auditioned for the actor's studio here and was like, I'm going to do this and incur the debt to do it. So I did that and it brought me to New York, which I think was the most significant part about it. Although I'm sure some of that training is inborn. And over that, I met at the actor's studio in my first year Brett Christensen was there.
Oh, wow. Huh. UCB guy.
Yeah, big old school UCB guy. Mm-hmm. He told me two things. He dropped out after the first year, and he told me two things. He told me to go to UCB and take classes and to listen to the magnetic fields. And I did I did neither of those things for 6 years. Like when I did, I was like, I should listen to Brett.
Yeah.
Like years ago.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Years ago. So I finished up my MFA, and then I was like, I've been in school for so long. I'm just going to fucking live. But part of the impetus for going to the MFA program is my best friend is a guy named Steve Waltin, who's an improvised Shakespeare, who is on the Second City main stage, who went to I.O.
Jordan Klepper's writing partner.
Jordan Klepper's writing partner. And we're best friends since high school, since like our sophomore, junior year in Vermont. And we knew each other as kids, but never really clicked until then. And like you do this thing with your best friend where it's like, I don't know if other people do this, but you're like, that's your thing. Like, he went from college right to Chicago.
Okay.
He's like, I'm doing comedy. And
right.
People would say, you got to go do improv. You'd be great at it. And I was like, nah, I'm doing the serious acting thing. Like, that's Steve's thing.
Right.
And then finally, I just was like, I'll take the class. And when I got here, the first class with Shannon O'Neill, I was done. I was like, it's over.
Yeah.
It's it. I'm done. Like, tap, put it in my vein.
Yeah.
I'm fucked.
Yeah.
I mean, I really felt, I don't know what it was. I mean, I when I explain it now, I'm like, I love it so much more because I can do anything. I can do anything on that stage. Mm-hmm. And coming out of grad school for acting, everyone's like, let's go do this little black box thing for this thing that somebody wrote that nobody will come see.
Right.
And you're dressed as like a Hitler clown, but it's a metaphor. And you're like, yeah. I don't get to do.
You're like, where's the blackface?
Yeah. Polynesian face. You don't get to do like all the stuff you're doing in grad school is like Beckett or Tennessee Williams.
Yeah.
Or
somber and Shepherd. Ponderous.
Yeah, even, or like well-written.
Well-written.
Like, well done stuff.
Like, yeah. Well-written. Yeah.
Classic
meaty
texts.
Parts that
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Are fun to do.
Yeah.
And then you come out and you're like, doing like this is a metaphor for Howard Hughes' impotency,
yeah.
But it's set in the desert.
Yeah, you
look, know, I worked like, very hard on that play. Okay?
It was good. I mean, there were some structural elements I would have changed.
But I guess overall, we can talk about it off mic.
Maybe just like cut
a lot of Howard Hughes research.
First,
went
second,
into that.
And third act. But then when I got here, I was just like, oh, I can be anything I want at any time. I can do a Tennessee Williams scene, or I can be an astronaut.
Mm-hmm. You can create your own meaty roles.
Whatever
scenes.
I want.
Yeah.
Whenever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just hooked. By our third class, we were applauding as people came in
for wow.
each other in Shannon O'Neill's class. She liked us. She drank with us at McManus for like yeah. 4 hours afterwards.
Yeah.
And there were some heavy hitters in that class that just didn't go on, but they were good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Greg Aponte, Mara Kane, Sarah Glom, Sarah Peterseal, Chris Enright. Jim, the stand-up from Philly who had his watch stolen out of the parking garage. Keith, who spammed people professionally, was what? In that class. A woman named Nini. I mean, my 101, I remember almost everybody. I'm mm-hmm. talking so much.
No, it's you're supposed to. There's so much to get to about you. So
you liked it right away. You'd already had acting training. What was hard for you to... I don't know. Tell me about like a breakthrough or something you remember learning or working on.
Well, my breakthrough, it's funny we say bad doctor scenes. My breakthrough in Doug Moe's class was like was a bad doctor scene. It was like I'm inept at performing the surgery. And then for my second beat, when I brought it back, I was inept at running a marathon. And I think those are like classic, like high status thing that's going on and I just can't do it. An alternate one is always like groovy doctor. Like, come on in. Get in my beanbag and I'll check your... You know,
yeah.
I think that was a little bit of a breakthrough. I know listening to John's very touching and awesome podcast you guys did last week.
Thank you.
Where it's never too late. I think I put a pressure on myself to feel like I felt like I was old. I felt like I came in at 28 and 29.
Mm-hmm.
And when I realized how much I loved it and how much I like wanted it, I didn't want to waste any more time. I remember actively thinking about, like, I think we all do this when we're nerding out, making a bumper sticker that was said like, I'd rather be improvising. I just thought about it. I would walk around. I'd do pattern games in my head.
Mm-hmm.
But there were so many breakthroughs. I mean, so many different people that said stuff. Charlie Todd telling me to listen to an older man in my third or 301 classes, like initiation. He's like, Ben, listen. And I knew that Charlie liked me. I knew that my teachers liked me because I worked hard and I loved it. At the same time, I try not to be overbearing. But to speak to what happened at Triple Crown that night when I was talking about Delaney's,
yeah.
I think part of the fact that I was older is that like I always had a hard time networking until I realized that you have to ask for what you want. And that's okay if you really want something. Remember, I asked you like around when we did Silly Little Game, I was like,
yeah,
I want to be a teacher, Will. How do I do that?
That's right.
And I was being earnest. Like, it's what I want.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I think you have to do that.
I think it's a tough thing for a lot of people, you know?
I think coming up through UCB, the way that I've been has certainly turned people off. Like, I'm sure when I was on Torco before I was on a weekend team, I asked everybody how to get on a weekend team, and they, like, I'm sure hated me for it. But it's what, I don't know. Ask for what you want. I think that's okay. Maybe you're overbearing, but most people aren't as overbearing as I am.
Well, people aren't used to it, you know? Like, the majority of us are like,
here?
Well, yeah. I think in general, I think the majority of people are like, oh, I really want this thing, but I don't know how
here,
to ask
for it.
Here,
I think there is an acute problem of people. Well, that's another thing about UCB itself. It's like, I think I was that first wave of, like, popularity UCB going into branding land. Like, now when I teach classes, I think it's a different element. Like, we've talked about this before, is that the frequency of the hand grenade or the weirdo is so much slimmer.
The density, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it's just that
there are
coming
less
through your classes. Mm-hmm. like the glorious weirdo, has, I think, become less frequent as I've been teaching here. And I'm like, am I part of that? Am I part of that class that was like UCB?
The gentrification.
The gentrification of UCB. And sometimes I feel guilty about it.
Although I people do say that, but I disagree with it.
Okay.
I think just as you've been around here longer, those X factors have less effect on you. I think if you ask students in 201 or 301, they're like, there's tons of weirdos.
Oh,
teachers
okay.
should be calling them out. Yeah. Why aren't the teachers like telling that weirdo to shut up? Like that's all that's all they think about are the weirdos.
Tell me how to do my fucking
and then
job.
Someone who's been here for like 5 years is like, they're not so bad and you're not so great, so shut up and don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the teacher's like, oh, you don't have weirdos. Like, I had a weirdo. I had a weirdo the teacher should have shut down. This weirdo is great.
Yeah.
You should listen to that weirdo.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I feel like, I mean, the community, I think the community is bigger and there is somewhat less of that. But I've heard that accusation, not even an accusation. I've heard that observation for like 6 years, like, oh, where'd all the weird people go? And I'm like, walk for 5 feet and look up and there'll be a weird person.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
everywhere.
But even like the roots of it, like when I know about it from the 99, like to 2003 of it, having like a very punk rock alternative subculture thing, like, I don't know if I would have fit in or it would have appealed to me at that point.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
In a way.
Sure.
I don't know. I don't know if I would have like been able to wade my way through it because of the way like I present myself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But like there were times in college when I was home like crying to Elliot Smith and Jeff Buckley and like the happiest I've ever been.
You don't know if you would have been able to wade through all the weirdos as a guy who painted metal figures.
Well, I'm saying you
somebody
don't
get as mainstream,
that from me.
Mainstream and normal as you.
When I had to get an A on my freshman algebra test to pass cuz I was so bad at math. My mom like said to me, "What can I do for you to make you pass this test?" And I told her, "Let her buy me a sword. I want a sword." And it's still in my room at
what?
Home.
Wow.
I love swords. I have a sword of El Cid. It's a beautiful sword. And then when my brother got married for my like being when I was in his groomsman, he got me like a two-handed Highlander. I have four swords hanging in my apartment at home.
That's amazing.
I'm a, like I played Phantasy Star. I would play Phantasy Star when I was in 7th grade. Phantasy Star 4 or whatever on Sega Genesis, and I'd have my brother's mix CD player in the back and there would be Blood Sugar Sex Magik in it. There would be Van Morrison's obscure Zen disc Enlightenment, which is has the words in it, but it's not about enlightenment. There's literally the line, like, the sound of one hand clapping, says in it. And then I had Dave Brubeck's Time Out, and it would just play on shuffle. It was a weird kid.
Yeah.
But I don't think you get that from.
No, I wouldn't assume that.
I would never assume that you were a sword owner.
Really?
Never.
I was big into myths. I think that's informs the way I play, too. It's like, I like those god figures.
Yeah. We are getting towards the end here.
Is that right?
I think so, yeah. We're almost at an hour.
I'm going to say a bunch of questions I'd like to ask that we don't have to answer. Maybe you can tell me which one's most interesting.
Okay.
None of them are really great. Like, I want to know why Ragnarok was bad at organic openings, which has a tacit assumption that Ragnarok was bad at them. Mm-hmm. They were certainly not excited about sound and movement openings. I'll say that. And then I was always fascinated by Ragnarok. I saw you guys as majorly awesome premise machines, like great premise first and second beats. Anybody in Ragnarok is a great game player.
Yeah. Game machines.
If they didn't were games going in, they were by the time they came out.
Yeah.
And but I think third beats were a trouble on Ragnarok. You guys had trouble like you guys had tons of amazing shows.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you weren't by design fundamentally the kind of team that rocked it in third beats. Airwolf, I think, is much more a team that's likely to blow it out and have like a nice big thunderous ending. So I want to know what the difference is. How do you have good third beats? How do you have good organic openings? How do you have great premises first and second beats? How do you handle friendships when you leave a team? Do you lose touch with people? Are you emotionally a better person because of doing improv, and in what way? How do you prepare for a script? You're a good actor, professionally memorizing lines.
Mm-hmm.
How did you become so successful? You book everything in commercials and voiceovers.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't you moving to L.A.?
Oh, Jesus.
Answer all those questions.
Okay. If you want to like, as a parent. organic.
And tell me about your mod team Gramps also.
Oh, where is it? Keep that in later. You can use my sound effect. I do voiceover.
Thank you for picking up on that. I was trying to work my way towards that.
Well, you know, why mess around?
I was on Onassis.
Even if it's a little bit by rote, just like throw
it
in there.
Can I answer you in a speed round?
Yeah. Want me just to ask them all again and you answer quick?
I'll do my best. If I miss one, you just ask me. It was an incredible disconnect with, and I became incredibly frustrated with Ragnarok internally. Although it bled out because we had the best group games. To this day, we talk about like Cat Economy, which is an insane name for a group game, but it just exploded. And it was the same thing as our organic openings. I didn't understand the disconnect. I was like, guys, we fucking, after a while, I didn't passively aggress. I would just be like, we nail these group games. Just do the same thing in our openings. They're identical.
Yeah.
We jump on, we support, we go. But for some reason, we just couldn't do it. We could never nail down those. And we stuck with it, like doggedly.
Yeah.
Doggedly until we finally changed. I still have sustainable friendships. Gladwell, Pat. I mean, everybody. Emily's on my team.
Yeah.
Good friends with Morgan. I grab beers with Dyes all the time.
Yeah.
I love those guys. I think there were maybe some hurt feelings when I left. I didn't ask to go to Batman.
No, you got moved.
I got moved. When I did go to Batman, I felt incredibly relieved. I didn't realize that I'd sort of been in my head on Ragnarok for a while. And Ragnarok, I should say, is great, great team to be on. But stylistically, I think they had like a young voice. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Not that they were underdeveloped, but like they liked to do stuff that was a little bit more like fantastical. Like there's a lot of like butterflies. I remember a lot of like butterfly scenes and like fairies and unicorn scenes. And after a while, I was just like a little bit tired. I think the longer you do this, like you go from sweet chocolate to dark chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Batman couldn't fucking nail down a game to save his life, but we would blow shit out, and it just felt a little bit. And you're not so precious about it in your second team,
right?
And I think Batman coming into like Airwolf, that's where that exploding to the ceiling comes through.
Yeah,
why Ragnarok couldn't nail third beats? I don't know.
Sometimes you did. It's unfair to say that.
No, that's okay. I don't know. Maybe there was a limit, or maybe we just hadn't developed at the time an ability to move laterally with a game that we were still in that sort of like president to the moon.
I think it's hard to logically blow out third beats, and you have to just kind of feel the music of it.
I agree.
And Ragnarok preferred to logic their way along.
Yeah.
And I think you also can sometimes start to, like, you believe that it has to be some amazing thing, you know?
Right.
There has to be some huge leap from the second beat to the third beat, you know, which I thought for a long time, and I don't necessarily believe that anymore. As somebody that hasn't done a Harold in 7 years.
Yeah. How did I go on to book anything? I just, like, stopped giving a shit. I know a lot of people say that, but it's like I just go in there and I be myself. When I take a script, I read through it, and then I read it aloud so I can hear the other person's dialogue, so I understand what I'm responding to in all the lines, and then I'll do some light script analysis. If I can go back in the script, I'll take a peek at it. Sometimes you don't get it. In commercials, I just say what I want, or if something's clunky, I'll just put it in my own language. And then I'll add a button at the end, or I'll put something funny in the middle. But mostly my check technique is just speaking subtext. Because for some reason in commercials right now, that's what's really funny. They just want you to say something that's borderline rude, deadpan, and truthful.
Yeah.
And if you can do that, like just being a good straight man, which is I think is a good straight man, is like, I mean, man, I think you're being really obtuse, man.
Yeah.
That's like what they're after.
Yeah.
Very often. But that's also relationships I've developed with people over like 8 years.
Right.
So I don't know. What was the other question?
Relationships with casting people and things
like that. Yeah, over time. Mm-hmm. And I was in the non-union world for a while, and a lot of that crosses over. They do both. They both do union and non-union. So, but I started off doing voiceover, and then I had to bleed into on-camera, and now I've been fortunate enough to
Are you a better person because of your improv training?
I'm a much better person.
In what way?
I'm a better listener. I'm more present. When I'm in a bind, I lean on improv techniques. Like, I'll just yes and somebody just to, like, get it positive, steer it out of control. I'm much more charming. I am. We're all more charming because we're in a conversation. You're identifying what somebody's doing, and you point it out for them. They love it. When you're, like, at a party with boring people, and you do – sorry, I shouldn't say that.
No, it's okay.
But maybe this is the thing that we all go through is, like, when we're stuck in a situation not with comedians.
Yes, I know what you mean.
Yeah. And you just do a callback, people love that.
Mm-hmm. It's true. People never expect anyone to remember anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, I mean, not that it's like my goal to be charming, but that's like an added benefit. Yeah.
How come you don't move to L.A.? Why aren't you in L.A., professional actor, booking everything?
I don't know. I'm scared.
Yeah.
I'm scared of it. I'm scared of failure. This is the most honest I've ever been about it to you right now because you asked me that. Mm-hmm. I pad it when I answer. I say, like, I don't like the driving and I don't want to reboot. That's all part of it. Part of me feels like I'm old. I don't know if I want to go out there and have to start all over. What if I hate it? Mm-hmm. I love New York City. You come outside and whether you're fucking rich or poor, you're surrounded by so many different people. In LA, you're in a car to a house, back to a car, to an audition. Everybody's an actor. I sat on the train on the way home yesterday and I was like, I don't know. I was listening to Kendrick Lamar or something, and this group of Greenpoint Polish dudes like came in, and they were construction dudes, and they were just talking over me aggressively and doing strange handshakes. And I was like, that won't happen if I go to LA. Mm-hmm. Also, I think of it, and I could be wrong, and everybody who goes out there is like, no, you're fine, you'll get on shows. I don't know if my generation is out there yet. There's certainly people out there, but it's the bottleneck to end all bottlenecks. The UCB4 perform out there.
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah, getting on the UCB stage would be a lot harder.
You don't have the like comfort of like just being able to get into a show, the same level of sort of comfort that you have here.
There's no bar. I mean, like, you can't drink and drive. Not that I want to drink and drive, but like, you can't. There's no community. I mean, there's birds next door, but there's no back room. There's no green room. Shows are shorter. People don't hang out. You know, I don't know. I should go there. That's where the work is. But
I appreciate your honest answer.
I'm afraid.
You're afraid of like the failure and of the like not having that kind of social
also to talk
backdrop
about, like,
and safety net.
Yeah, talk about like having ambition here and doing shit. Like, I'm in the fucking catbird seat. This is another thing I want to say, is that when you get to be I'm calling myself a high-level improviser, a veteran improviser, like, I still want to do shows. I want to do shows every night of the week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Every night of the week I want to do a show. Mm-hmm. And people, we talked about this, Will, it's like you get to the weekend and people forget about you in a way.
Yeah.
Harold Knight is truly, like you said,
Harold Knight's the heart
of the theater. Yeah. But like,
it's true. I feel like that too.
Show, Hot for Teacher, I'm thrilled. Play-by-play, ecstatic. Mm-hmm. Anything. Even I tell weekend teams all the time, I've texted you.
Yes, you have.
I'm like, I will sit in on your show.
Yes. If you let me know that. That was funny.
I let you know. Because I feel like, again, it's ask for what you want. Yeah. I want to play with the Stepfathers. I want to play with the Curfew, Law Firm, Grandma's Ashes. I'll do anybody's show.
Yeah.
I'll go to an opening of an envelope if I can improvise there. But now I'm like, I'm where I want to be. I'm in Torco.
Right.
I play with like some of my best friends every Saturday to sold out houses. We go off to festivals all the time.
It's pretty good, right?
It's true, and it's hard to leave that.
Yeah,
you know?
It's a seesaw effect. It's like, what are you going
to
do?
But I feel like you and I have talked about this. Like, oh, and I want to say something that you said to me. I know we're kind of running long here, but
no time limit.
Okay. You said something to me because I was bitching
to
you.
What time does Italy close?
I got to get a flight at 6.
Now we are reaching the end of the show because this is the beginning, like T.S. Eliot would
That's
say.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
The fire and the rose.
I was bitching to you about being too old and feeling like I'd missed out on things. And you said to me something that really stuck with me that I think about a lot. I said to you, I feel like I missed the boat.
Yeah.
I feel like I missed the boat on like, you know, because people that I came up with are gone, and like I can't seem to latch on to any generation of performers here or any sort of group of people here. And I said, I feel like I missed the boat. And you looked at me and you said, the boat leaves every 15 minutes. Yeah. And I was like, "That he's fucking right.
It's true.
You know, it does.
I'll give you another good one.
Okay.
Sort of slowly, like redemption is just an edit away.
I like the improv parlance.
Yeah.
It's true.
But I think, you know, we've talked about this, and one of the things I've
is your generation, man. You're great.
I guess so. Thank you.
It loves you.
Thanks for saying that. If I could get this podcast every day. So I think with, like, you know.
Can I answer all your questions?
Yep.
I think I think you're in a great spot right now. You know, like from what I notice about you, I think you're in a really good spot, like you said. And I think that eventually, like, it's going to, just like you coming to UCB when it was the right time for you to come, I think, like, you're going to get swept up into that next level when it's the right time for it to happen.
Let's hope so, because then we can all get rich and famous and I can hire talented people to do whatever. Or they can, that's what the goal is, right? Yes. We were talking about this too the other day. It's just like, so you can make the shit you want to make with the people that you love.
Yeah.
Hopefully, you know, you never know. It is weird. It's weird to sort of get to this place, but it took a village. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, big things in my life were all of my teachers giving me hard notes, all of my coaches on Harold Knight, being on Onassis with very talented people, with Seth Reese, like the head writer of The Onion, like directing us, and then doing those sketches. Like, and then it's just been picks and pecks, like being good enough to, is that even an expression? Who knows? Being on now showcases, like doing like the SNL callback at the Pit, like it all is part of it. And it didn't happen overnight.
Right.
But I knew I was in for the long haul. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's just like.
When you were clapping for people on Shannon O'Neill's level 101.
As soon as they walked in the door. I mean, yeah.
How much of, is there a difference between like the choices that you're making at the top of an improv scene and the choices that you make when you get a script of a sketch or of a like commercial or something you're auditioning for? Like, does one of them influence the other or?
Commercial's all improv.
Right.
When I get a commercial script, I look at it and I look at the words that I think aren't the jokes and then I make them my own. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like all this shit that's like, come on, man. Or if the joke, if the line, not the joke, but if the line is like, why are you doing that, buddy? I'll just be like, come on, man. Because the more colloquial I can make it for me, the more relaxed I'll be. I'm okay. Not going to take a writer's joke away. Mm-hmm. A little bit with sketch, too. I'll do that. I'll soften it a little bit, a certain line, but I'll hit the joke lines.
Mm-hmm. And the choices that you're making about like the kind of person this is or what they might be thinking or like
I mean,
a way
again,
to approach
it's the GCs,
this.
It's like given circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sketch, it's... I mean, it's a little bit, it's sort of in that middle ground between like dramatic stuff. Like if I have a script, I'm going to go back and take a peek at like, where's this person walking in from? What's their situation? Mm-hmm. How did that affect them before the scene? How is that affecting them in the moment? But through all of them, there's always just the same line of just listening. It's always listening. Mm-hmm. Improv, listening is king. Sketch, listening is king. Certainly in dramatic stuff, not dramatic stuff, but like in written, like when I was going out for pilot season, it's just, what are you giving me? And like responding with the words through whatever it is that's going on between us.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm going out for like, if I go out for like a TV thing, I'll be as fucking off book as possible. So I just don't have to look at the page.
Right.
Sketch, I'll wait because it's so fluid and it changes, you know, for a little while. But once it gets to that last rehearsal, I'll try my best to, like, lock it down. And it also depends, like, what's great about sketch and improv, I think, is it Alan Arkin who said this? It's like, people who do that shit, like, know what their role is. Which is not to say condescending, but when you get a sketch, when I get a sketch with Onassis, I'd be like, what am I? Unusual person? Straight man? Okay, I know what my job is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to feed it to you. Maybe I get, like, one zinger in there
mm-hmm.
or react. But I know where the meat and potatoes is. I know what the cake is. I know what the frosting is. To use food from Italy. What else? Keaton, you have any questions for me?
Yeah. Did you listen to the Magnetic Fields?
Keaton asked if I listened to the Magnetic Fields. I don't know if the mic picked it up. I did. Yeah, 69 Love Songs. Right? Yeah.
What's the first song you thought of?
When you said that, the book of love is love. When I was a bartender, I'd get drunk and come home and listen to that. I was a sad dude oftentimes. And that's a bad album to listen to when you're sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anything else?
No, I think that was good.
Yeah. We don't have time to dive deeply into Bruce Springsteen, unfortunately.
Oh, that affects my improv.
How so?
Bruce?
Yeah.
He's the ultimate showman. He knows. Uh-huh. He knows how to set a stage. And also very big genre pieces. Like all of this stuff is very Americana, single man against the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's interesting because he picked a version of himself he wanted to be, forced himself to be that person. So therefore he's kind of lying, or at least he was when he was younger. But it works somehow.
Yeah, it works.
Like you listen to his songs, they sound earnest. But it's like you're not, especially like around Born to Run, he's not the person that he wants to be yet. He's a kid from Jersey wishing he was like, you know, Woody Guthrie.
Oh yeah, Wild and
and Elvis Presley combined,
and Bob Dylan,
and Wild Dylan. He wishes he was all those things.
Yep. Oh,
and he's so none of them. His early, but he's great, it's great.
His early demos are straight up Bob Dylan.
Normally, like people who try to fake their way into being somebody else, you can smell it, and it's not good.
Yeah,
but he was awesome the whole time. Why is that? Why is there his earnestness is impressive?
Some people are just
me.
Good at faking it until they make it. Some people are just good at like, this is who I'm going to be. This is what I want to be.
There was an air of mystery around him that like obscured who he was. I mean, you can't say that Born in the USA was his best album, but it really crystallized himself in the vision of America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, he became sort
pretty
of America's
album,
spokesman.
But in a way, it was a throwback. Like, that's why it had such mass appeal. Because rock and roll definitively is escapism, always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what's great about rock and roll. And the biggest, like, representation of rock and roll, at least from the 50s until the late, the 70s, no, well, yeah, the, like, Woodstock, but was the car. That's why so much music was about car, because it epitomized getting away. I have a car, I can go.
Yep.
Darkness on the edge of town. What's out there? I can fucking figure it out. Born to run.
Yeah.
Strap your wheel, strap your legs across this engine.
Thunder Road.
Thunder Road. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why that car culture was like, at that point, kind of a throwback. Like that was mostly 50s stuff.
I like to think of Born in the USA as, I like to pretend that it was an indie album that nobody knew about when I listened to it.
It's too clean. Everything's 2.5 minutes.
I pretend that it's like a little gem that I found that no one knows about. That Born in the USA is a hidden little song, like a B-side.
I'm on fire. It's like 2 minutes and 13
great
seconds.
Great song. Yeah.
And I'll just loop it.
Downbound Train's a great song. Dancing in the Dark's a great song. Great Take song. Out that keyboard.
Yep.
Yeah, but you need that keyboard.
I don't need it.
Everything
right.
on.
We didn't mean to really talk about this, but we did it. We're going to have another podcast all about
just
this.
Just about Bruce Springsteen. We're going to have a round table.
Oh, I'll be
about,
on that.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Round table discussion of Bruce
talk
Springsteen.
About Nebraska.
Yeah.
Go crazy.
Oof.
What's your favorite album?
Nebraska. No, that's not true. Darkness on the Edge of Town.
You just flew off Monty Python. You just flew off the bridge. What's yours?
Yeah, I'm also trying to make the same decision. I think it's Darkness on the Edge of Town.
Are we all Darkness fans?
You can't lose God Darkness.
Me, yeah.
Darkness on the Edge of Town. You too, you big Darkness fan?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. If you, let me, can I from that, can I make an assumption?
Mm-hmm.
Favorite Star Wars movie in the second, well, whatever, first trilogy time-wise, Empire.
Oh, yeah, for
both
sure.
Of you.
I know that is the most Darkness on the Edge of Town of them, but Star Wars is still my favorite.
Really?
Oh, Empire is the best.
You Empire,
saw
the end of Empire
you saw
ruins
the theater. Star Wars.
I saw them all in the theater originally. Star Wars was like the second movie I ever saw, but then when they came out in the '90s with like the new music and cleaned up things,
yeah,
I watched them. I was like, the end of Empire is bad.
Wait
what do
a minute!
You mean it's bad.
That's father. It's hokey. Like oh, father. So you know it to be true. Like,
no, he's hokey.
Yeah, that's right. But
Mark Hamill is like
a lot of the ending is lame.
I can okay.
The first two thirds of Empire are amazing, and then it's like after school special.
I can extrapolate what kind of person anybody is by cross referencing their favorite Indiana Jones and their favorite Star Wars.
Raiders and Star Wars.
Last Crusade. You're an optimist. What are yours?
That
was Keaton. Keaton said Last Crusade.
You've done radio before?
No, yeah, he's very mindful of who's on the mic, right?
Yeah.
I've never really...
I don't want Keaton to be heard.
Well, he's not. I'm speaking as Keaton.
Huh.
I mean, I'm speaking as Keaton.
It probably is. It probably is Raiders.
Raiders,
you know what?
Empire.
I have a special affection for Temple of Doom because I saw it in the theater.
Yeah.
I saw Temple of Doom and...
Last Crusade.
You would have this debate.
What do you mean?
If you were Temple and Empire... But that's a lot of darkness. I bet like 5 years ago you'd be Temple Empire.
Maybe. Yeah.
What are your favorites, Ben?
Mine's Raiders and Empire.
Yeah.
But I think I do like Raiders of the Lost Ark more.
Raiders is the best one. It's the origin story.
Yeah.
And Indiana Jones.
And Marion
is
awesome.
Although
he's the best female
Wait,
protagonist.
You know what? Actually, I'm sorry. It is Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. That is my
favorite.
Oh, boy.
We got to end on that. Somebody's got to get to
Thank you, Ben Remaker, for being on this podcast.
Thanks, Ben. This is great.
Thank you, Sypha.
50 more hours to talk.
I had so much fun.
Thank you, Keaton. Guys.
Thanks, Sypha. Thanks, Keith.
Thanks, everybody.
John Bashanti.
Thanks, Will Hines. Bye.
I think it's pretty good.
Steven, what's his name?
Check, check. One, two.
The other good one was on the, like, the one with the old man on the tricycle. What was that one?
Jane. Maybe you should drive. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
And then the one that sounds
no
like
more,
a pirate ship.
What is it? No more something to my Evan. Mm-hmm. Who's the Blake Babies girl? Juliana Hatfield. No, Juliana
oh, yeah.
to my Evan. That's a line of that song.
Yeah.
No Juliana to my Evan. Yeah.
And then the other one was scenes from whatever from a pirate ship was good too.
Yeah, born the first three. Born on a pirate ship.
Oh yeah,
born on a pirate ship.
But Shoebox.
Companion piece to They Might Be Giants.
Yeah, they were like a kind of less self-aware. They Might Be Giants or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay.